One before we started this year to maybe share a little divrei hesped from Reb Chaim. So maybe since we missed the actual hesped, so just to share a couple thoughts and then we'll begin. So I first heard of Reb Chaim Kanievsky. It was Shana Aleph in KBY, and Reb Blachman gave a chabura on Nefesh Chaim, and so we're learning Torah, what Torah Lishma is, Char Dalet. So I don't remember exactly what question prompted this, but somebody asked something along the lines of, is there anyone who learns Torah Lishma? To which Rav Blachman responded, Rav Chaim Kanievsky. So at that time, I had not heard of Rav Chaim Kanievsky. That was the first I'd ever heard of him. And he wasn't nearly as famous more than 20 years ago as he is now. And Rav Blachman said he's someone who just sits and learns all day. He has no position, no other reason for learning other than Torah Lishma. So that was the first I heard of Rav Chaim Kanievsky. And one of the amazing things of Rav Chaim Kanievsky is because of his absolute mastery of Kol HaTorah Kula, that any question you had, he had an answer with a makor, and almost always a makor in Chazal. I'll tell you one story that I just heard from Rav Sarfati. I think he told me this on the way home from yeshiva on Wednesday. Maybe it was Tuesday. Tuesday, actually. An amazing story. This is a story he knows the brother of whom this happened to, who I think lives in Passaic. So a secondhand story. There was once a couple that was engaged, and while they were engaged, it turned out that the chassan was diagnosed with cancer and a very serious diagnosis. So the brother who of the person that Sarfati knows, he was in America for his other his nephew's chasana, he quickly left back to Eretz Yisrael, and basically what happened was that the chasan's family told the kala's family, look, we totally understand if you don't want to go for it. Why would you marry me? Chassan said, I don't know where I'm going to be next year or 2 years, or why should you have to get married and live this type of life? And so, if you want to end it, that's totally okay. It's probably also true that they were Hasidic couples that, it's not like they knew each other so well at that point anyway. So the Kala's family said, we have to go ask Reb Chaim. So they go to Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim says, "Nishalas ha'na'ara." What does she have to say? So they ask her, and she says, "I want to marry him, but I don't want to back out." So Reb Chaim thinks for a moment. What's a makor? How do you solve this? Not so much a shaila of psak, but direction in Chazal as to what to do about this case. So he comes up with a Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi says that when Alexander was becoming the emperor, he went to different countries to examine their ways, to figure out how they rule. So he went to a certain far-flung country and he observed this king. And while he was there, two people came before the king. One of them was the buyer of a property, said, we bought this property, and in this property was a pile of gold buried hidden. And we bought the property. We had no intention to buy the gold, so it belongs to the mocher. And the mocher says, no, we sold you as is. We had intention, which is true, we didn't know where the gold was, but we had intention to sell you this property, and the gold was in the property, it's yours. So the king thinks about it. And the king says, do you have a son? He says, yeah. Do you have a daughter? They say, yeah. Okay. So when they get married, and they'll share the fortune. So Alexander observes this, and he's looking very troubled. So the king asks him, well, what would you have done? So Alexander says, I would have killed them both and taken the money. So Reb Chaim said, look, a marriage that starts with each one trying to give to the other is like this mechira. In that case, the mocher wanted to give to the seller wanted to give to the mocher. And such a marriage is appropriate. And indeed, they got married, and Rabbi Sarfati points out that they have five kids now. They're still, Baruch Hashem, he's alive. Agav, there's a very interesting Chafetz Chaim, which I think adds to the story, that has an interesting take on that Yerushalmi. Chafetz Chaim asks, why did Alexander need to kill them? If he wanted the money, he should have just taken the money. And besides which, Alexander wasn't known as being someone who was particularly cruel. So why did he kill them? Since the pshat is that Alexander was a nation builder, he was an empire builder. How did America become so rich? Just 3 centuries, and it's the most powerful country in the world. Because everybody wants the American dream. Everybody wants to be successful. Everybody wants to be rich. Everybody's ambitious materially. And so when you have a country where everybody is materially ambitious and wants the American dream, so that's going to produce a healthy, strong economy and a strong country. It's not for the generosity of the baker that he bakes his bread. It's because he wants the money. And in a society like that, then everything will work out. But Alexander said, if you have a society where everybody is just trying to give of what is theirs, so everybody's being mevater, you'll never create a strong society. You need that monetary drive. So he says, I would have killed them. There's no place for such people in a country that I want to build. And what he didn't understand is that when you give, you get as well. So that's one of millions of stories from Reb Chaim Kanievsky, through his mastery of Kol Tor Kula, really had an answer to every question. I think one of the things that I was remember being inspired by Reb Chaim, I read a couple of years ago an interview. Somebody had interviewed his son. And the son reported that his father, of course, was a masmid atzum. He never stopped learning. And his son said, does it bother you that, you know, you spend so much time dealing with people? His house was open. I was zochah to be in his house. You know, on the one hand, you know, he treasured his time so much and his strength so much. Everybody likes to talk about the buha, right? But at the same time, in the end of the day, he made time for everybody. And his house was open. He didn't have to have an open house, and he did. And it took hours. He answered every question. When I was learning in Eretz Yisrael, my roommate, Chaim Hillowitz, and I, we both sent him a question. Of course, mine was answered first, because I was a Kohen. He said he was Mekayim v'Kidashto by answering the letters of the Kohanim first. But, you know, it wasn't like a brilliant question. It didn't make any sense to ask him this question. We could have asked any posek. He wasn't our posek. But whatever, that's, you know, the type of silly things you do when you're Shana Aleph, and it made sense. But he did. He answered both of our questions. You know how, you know, short answers, one line each to each question. You know how nowadays it's sort of in style that in emails, you know, you answer in line, you know, under each question, you write the answer. So that's what he did. So in between the lines, he answered the multiple questions. But, you know, he answered hundreds of letters every day. And again, they weren't like these great pressing questions, but he took the time. So his son asked him, you know, doesn't it bother you, you know, to spend so much time doing these silly things? And his answer is no, because that's what I'm supposed to be doing now. Everything has its place. Sometimes you'll have a great masmid, but, and there's going to be something that he should be doing other than learning now. And it bothers him, you know, I should be learning now. So it eats him up. And what he told his son was basically, look, not using these words, but what he was saying was, I learn because that's Ratzon Hashem. That's the right thing to do. And right now it's Ratzon Hashem for me to do this, to greet people and give them brachos and hear their sad stories or answer their questions or the like. And if that's Ratzon Hashem, so why should I feel bad about it? My job is to do Ratzon Hashem. I'm not learning to be a gadol. I'm not learning to do anything other than Ratzon Hashem. And so if this is what's called for now, then that's what I'm going to do. And there's no reason to feel bad about it. Everything had its time. Everything had its place. Everything had its makor. I think one of the things that's so amazing is you have a person who was totally mufka from the world in every sense. I remember also reading in that interview of him that somebody once showed him a picture of himself. And he was shocked to see how old he was. He was in his 90s at the time. And that's because he had never seen, or he, you know, been years, I guess, since he'd ever seen himself. For one thing, because he was someone who always followed what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch, the Rama says, you're not allowed to look in a mirror. So he didn't look in a mirror. Besides which, I don't think he would have looked at in a mirror. But so he was surprised to see how old he looked, how white, you know. Maybe the last time he saw an image of himself was when he was 16. I don't know. But he was surprised. But he was mufka in every sense. His wife used to tell him what food he was eating so he would know which bracha to make. Or and maybe I think she just told him what bracha to make because he, otherwise he was just learning.
Rabbi Zinzi told us that he went to ask him, because Rabbi Zinzi has a whole shtick on that the bracha he holds it shtick. So he wanted to get asked about Rabbi Zinzi. Different from Chaim, and Chaim told me he doesn't know shtick.
Right, exactly.
You have to explain to him what it is.
So on the one hand, he could be so mufka from the world. At the same time, he was so me'ura v'nebrios and so loved by everyone when you went and you visited him. He smiled. He was cheerful. He was both mufka and totally present. And Rav Tursky actually, in one of his COVID letters or the like, writes about how there are different types of gedolim. One type of gadol is a gadol batorah who leads by being totally shakua in Torah and having no connection to the world, but other than through his Torah. And there's another type of gadol who leads by being very much aware of what's going on in the world and integrating his Torah in that sense. And there's a need for both, and they both serve their place. I think another thing I want to bring out, which is, I think, relevant for everyone in this room to think about, is that he had the confidence to do his own thing, even though that was different than what everybody else was doing. Now, it's easy to say that, you know, when he was a Gadol HaTorah, but he did that from when he was young. In other words, when he was young, he appreciated this is the derech that's best for me to learn. And it's different than everybody else. And so because this was the path that he chose, people didn't think of him as particularly smart or the like, you know, who's a Talmud Chacham, someone who's a Lamdin, who has good Lamdish Shtiklach, who goes slowly and does a couple daf every zman and says Shtikl Teres. No, this was, he appreciated the way that makes most sense for him to learn a lot and quickly, what we might sometimes call bivkias, and the fact that everybody else didn't do it that way didn't stop him from just following the crowd and other ways as well. He got married relatively late. He couldn't find a shidduch. not just because he wasn't known as such a great learner because he was learning with Pius, but also because he had a beard. And in those days, at the very least, it wasn't in the Kubal to have a beard, a Bachar would shave, and he held, this is what I should do, and he did it. Everything worked out. He ended up with quite an Eishes Chayil. His learning, you know, I think in the end of the day, he probably if he would have gone the traditional route, he also would have been a Talmud Chacham, and I'm sure he would have had nice Shtiklach, but he wouldn't have been Reb Chaim. He became Reb Chaim because he forged his own path. And it was done, I think, with the support and encouragement of his teachers, but still to have the guts to do something different than everybody else, and not just everybody else, everybody than his teachers. I think he thought of his Rebbeim as the Stipler, his father, the Chazon Ish, and Rav Shach, but he was very different than all of them. His father, the Stipler, he learned Be'iyun. His shtiklach are in Iyun, mostly on the Yeshiva Shemesachto, so not exclusively. Certainly that was the Derech of Shach. And even though in a sense there is a commonality with the Chazon Ish, in the sense that the Chazon Ish didn't treat any chelek in Torah differently than any other part. The Chazon Ish talks just as much about Tmura and Shvius and Kilayim as he does about Bava Kam and Bava Metzim, Bava Lasra. And also, in a sense, he too didn't do the standard yeshivish thing. But at the same time, he was also different than the Chazon Ish. If you read the Chazon Ish, you read the Chaim Kanievsky's Svarim, they're totally different from each other. Chazon Ish is full of tremendous chidushim, and Reb Chaim is a Pashtun, and he again, they're Chidushim as well, but for the most part, it's presenting whatever he's presenting. If it's a Derech Emunah, he's presenting the Rambam in a very simple, straightforward way that you could understand. Sometimes he'll have ayins to what the Acharnish HaTorah are on that particular thing. But in the end of the day, he explains it kipshuto. We were just learning tremendous chiddush of the Chaye Adam on Soveya last week. So it's all based off of the Yerushalmi. So if you look at Reb Chaim Kanievsky on that Yerushalmi, which are from his shiurim, he presents Yerushalmi kipshuto, and he writes at the end, I'm Chaye Adam. Okay, he knew the Chaye Adam. He didn't quote what he said. It's not the Pashtus in Yerushalmi. His Derech HaLimud was certainly different than anybody else's. I don't think, you know, there's anybody else who learned the way he did. But that's, he appreciated that that's what was right for him. And because he had that courage to do what he thought was right, to learn in a way that he thought was right, that's how he became what he became. And I think that that's particularly important in terms of understanding his role as someone amongst the Chachmei Mesorah. Sometimes we think that the Mesorah is transmitted by a Talmud imitating his Rebbe, being just like his Rebbe. And that's not true. Take a look, for example, at the Rav's greatest Talmidim. Each one of them sees himself, or at least correctly, as carrying on the Rav's legacy, not because he is imitating the Rav and even learning in the same style as the Rav, but is nevertheless carrying on that legacy in their own unique way. Taking that those teachings that they got from their Rebbe and continuing the Mesorah, integrating their own chelek with the chelek that they received from their Rebbeim. Somebody actually, Agav, told me this story. I heard from Diane Lichtenstein. He was from the Boston area. He never learned in YU. He learned in the Mir. He became an Av Beis Din of the Federation in London. I think he's now retired. He moved back to Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, but he used to learn with the Rav in the summer. And so once the Rav mentioned that his father, Rav Moshe, used to take out the coins from his pocket before he went into the bathroom, because the coins said, "In God we trust." And he held that, or the bills, I don't know which one, but the money out of his pocket, because he felt that you can't bring the name of God into the bathroom, even if it wasn't a written big kedusha. So one of the Talmidim there, with a little bit of chutzpah, asked, "Do you do that, Rebbe?" So the Rav said, "No." So he said, "Why not?" He said, "Because if I were to do it, I would be a copycat. And I'm not a copycat. So I can't tell you exactly what he meant, because it's obvious that in many of his hanhagos, he did exactly what his father did and his grandfather did. But the Rav felt that for whatever reason, to follow that particular hanhaga of his father would have been being a copycat. And he's not a copycat. And so that's why the Rav, I think, felt that he was carrying on the Mesorah of his father, of his grandfather. It was very different in many ways than Reb Chaim on various positions that he took, whether it was with respect to Zionism or secular learning, whatever it is. But he carried on that Mesorah. He took the Mesorah that he got and he applied it in his own time, in his own way. And carrying on being part of the Chachmei Mesorah doesn't mean being a copycat. It means taking that Mesorah and transmitting it in your own way. That's maybe a bigger topic to consider, what exactly that means. But I think that is something that we see with Reb Chaim. And as I said, there's much more we could say, but maybe also in keeping with the teachings of Reb Chaim, we should get back to learning and begin our shir. But certainly, Yehi Zichro Baruch, we should be zolcha to be Mari de Maus. And certainly, his Sfarim are something that are a legacy. Even in his Sfarim, first of all, there's so many of them are so different from each other. I think what they say is that he used to write, he had a whole machzor to Chazar Kol Tarkula every year. Kol Tarkula, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Sifra, Sifrei, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, every year. So when there was an Uber Yar, he would have an extra month. So that's when he would write a Sefer. So if you look at the Sfarim on the dates, they're always there, always an Uber Yar. And they're so fascinating. Many of them are taking some type of obscure source, some oftentimes a source in Chazal that nobody ever really learns or understands, and explaining it, elucidating it. His Sfarim, Derech Emuna, is such an incredible resource. It's like, if you haven't learned it, it's like a Mishnah Berurah on Sefer Zeraim of the Rambam. His Sfarim are also incredible, and certainly his legacy lives on in his Sfarim, in his Talmidim, and in all of Klal Yisrael. Okay, so